Packaging versus Allen. Mr. DeMarco.
Good morning, Your Honors. Paul DeMarco for the plaintiffs. Your Honors, in granting summary judgment, the district court fundamentally altered Indiana's promissory
estoppel. The problem you have is that what on earth are the terms of this promise that you are trying to enforce?
The terms, Your Honor, of the promise itself, let's focus on the promise. Ray Martin said on three separate occasions that he promised to purchase $2 million in GPI stock and to close the transaction, the overall transaction, come hell or high water. Promised this in December of 1993. Promised this in November of 1993, December 1993,
yes,
and July 1994.
What is the content? What is the precise content of the promise?
It's $2 million in
for
exchange
what?
For stock.
For what? For how much stock?
Well, at the time of December
23rd. What is your demand? How much do you think your opponent is obligated to give you in the way of stock?
$2 million, which was at the time 18.8% of GPI, and that remained constant throughout the transaction. This is at least as definite and clear, Your Honor.
Well, wait a second. So you're seeking the I may have the parties reversed. You're seeking the 18.8%.
No. You do have the parties reversed, Your Honor.
You're getting the $2 million.
We are
and
seeking.
The question is what you're giving up.
We're seeking to enforce the promise.
So you want the $2 million. Okay. Now you're saying you're willing to give them, or the deal that you think was struck, you will give them 18.8% of the stock.
Well, because they broke the promise, Your Honor, the company went belly up. So there is no company anymore in which they can invest. It's much like the situation that existed, for example, I think in this court in the Gruen case. I think in First National Bank in the Indiana court.
Go ahead, finish.
First National Bank, I think, is key to the question you're asking, which I think goes to how definite does the promise have to be in the first instance under Indiana law. This
well,
court...
See, you appear to have alleged two promises.
Mm-hmm.
First, that Allen would invest the $2 million, and second, that Allen would ensure that the restructuring closed.
Right.
The second promise seems awfully vague and contingent. How could Allen possibly ensure that the deal would close given the number of other parties involved?
Let me answer it this way, Your Honor, by citing several of the cases that have confronted the same thing. First National Bank, for example. In First National Bank, the promise was we're going to make you a loan. Never specified how much the loan was, but and it never specified interest rate or anything like that. So the court there was dealing with a situation where a lot of things had to be done, too.
Yeah, but
and it
one,
said that's fine.
One party. I mean, look
right.
at all the parties we have involved here.
That's right. In the end, however, Your Honor, let's fast forward to the end. What does the evidence show was the reason why this deal did not come together as promised? And the reason why was... it is plausible to conclude that Allen simply changed its mind, precisely the wording used in the Bacardi case by this court. I can't think of a better analytical template to use, Your Honor, than to say, let's look at how this court approached it in Goldstick. In Goldstick, it was even more nonspecific. Remember, there the wording was, something will be worked out. Now, that obviously, Your Honor, left a lot to be done, too. But as Judge Posner wrote there, for contract purposes, that may be hopelessly vague. But for promissory estoppel purposes, that is a sufficient promise. And when you get into the issue of reasonable reliance, Judge Posner also said there, even though there is much left in doubt, that was his word in Goldstick, it still is plausible for the jury to conclude that that all could have been finished. Now, also remember the Husong Chow case, which is an Indiana Court of Appeals case. There, the court made a
but
very
important...
But
the problem is, suppose Allen hadn't changed his mind, if that's what happened,
mm-hmm.
What would the terms of the deal have been?
If Allen hadn't changed its mind, Allen would have purchased $2 million in stock, in cash, and all of the other entities that were part of this agreement, including co-parties and creditors, would have signed off on the deal, which would have meant an infusion of 2.305 in non-cash assets by Hobart. That was really what the deal coming together was all about.
But wasn't what Hobart was going to do in constant flux?
It wasn't. If you interpret the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, Hobart was on board at the end. Now, did Hobart give the same ironclad guarantee that Ray Martin did? No, Your Honor. There's no suggestion that Hobart did. But at the end of the day, Mr. Gleitzman's testimony is Hobart and all of the other parties, except Allen, were ready to go forward, which I think makes it, under the analytical template that we have of Goldstick, Zeiss...
Go forward with what? With the 18.8% or with something else?
Well, at the end, you remember that Hobart, for a time, pulled out. Then there's a letter of August 9th in which GPI and the Allen Group together say, okay, to get you back in, we will give you a little extra push, a little extra equity. Now, that was coming out of Garwood and McNamara's hide. It didn't affect Allen and Company. But at the end, that proposal was accepted by Hobart. The proposal of GPI and Allen Group was accepted by Hobart. They were on board. The closing was to be August 19th. The day before the closing is when Ray Martin pulled out. That directly violated his promise to put up the $2 million at the closing and to finish the transaction.
And so what would the stock deal have been then?
The stock deal for, at least as far as Allen is concerned.
Well, no, the entire deal, right? Because these other people have to be satisfied also. So how would the stock be distributed?
Your Honor, in terms of Hobart, it was going to be 25.5%. In terms of Allen and Company, I believe it was 18.8%. And there were existing creditors then that were going to divide the rest, including Mr. Garwood and Mr.
McNamara. And had they agreed, the other creditors?
Yes, they did.
So in your view,
mm-hmm.
just so I have it exactly
yes.
right, in your view, it is absolutely set in stone that the various documents to this transaction had all been finalized, that all of the terms had been agreed to, and the restructuring was ready to close, but for Allen's $2 million investment.
That's right, Your Honor. I think that's what the evidence shows.
But what is the evidence that you just said that all the creditors were willing to go along? That isn't my impression. Why do you say that?
Yeah. First of all, Your Honor, as we explain in our brief, from Mr. Gleitzman's testimony, Mr. Garwood's testimony, and the documents, there never was an intention that all of the creditors would sign releases. The IRS, it's explained in there, was not going to sign a release. They were going to be paid. There were many creditors that were going to be paid at the close.
And are you saying that Hobart had decided that even that it that would make this deal without knowing which creditors were going to go along with it?
The evidence, Your Honor, is that Hobart knew which creditors were going to go along. There's a list of creditors that talks about those that are going to be paid at closing. And then there are some creditors with an N by them that aren't going to be paid at all because those charges were being disputed. All of this was known to Allen, Hobart,
but
and BPI.
But did all the creditors... Was it known what the position of every creditor was?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. Mr. Garwood's testimony, which you'll see cited in our footnote, because we had said that the other side had mischaracterized the way that Mr. Garwood said this. He said he admitted that all of the creditors had to agree to releases, and his next sentence, which they left out, was "We did that." Your Honor, I want to bring your attention. I know I'm eating into my rebuttal time, but I do want to mention Exhibit 9. It is so important because it is what makes plausible this scenario that we are positing. And that is, this simply was Allen changing its mind. Exhibit 9 has that key statement from Mr. Martin in which he writes to himself, "Embarrassing, we can't raise $2 million, especially when everyone has agreed." Your Honors, I submit under the gold stick template under First National Bank, Hsu-Song Chau, and Bacardi, the way to view that is that it makes plausible that what we have here was a promise that was broken, not for any valid reasons, not for any conditions that were set in the original promise, but because the promisor simply changed its mind. Under Bacardi 1, this court said, Bacardi simply changed its mind, and General was not unreasonable for failing to anticipate that. That's exactly the situation, which we quote in our brief, it's exactly the situation we have here. On summary judgment, the plaintiff should have, the evidence should have been read in that light, and summary judgment should not have been entered against the plaintiff.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. DeMarco, Ms. Boshkoff.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ellen Boshkoff, and I represent the Appellees, Ray Martin, and Allen & Company. I want to go right to a point that Mr. DeMarco was discussing just a moment ago, whether there were terms to this deal. What you just heard Mr. DeMarco say, that Allen & Company was going to get 18.8%, that Hobart was going to get 25.5%, the creditors were all going to split this up, that's something that his own clients did not say in their depositions. When they were asked in their depositions how much stock Allen & Company was going to get for its investment, they couldn't say. It had been all over the map. It had been 14%. At one point, it was 16% when Mr. Martin made the first alleged promise. Then it was 18%. Then it was 18.8%. And what their own clients say, for example, Mr. McNamara's testimony, question, are you at some point going to take the position that the Allen investors were obligated to provide $2 million in exchange for something? Answer, yes. Question. And what is that something? That very question the court just asked. His answer, well, that something kept changing. Similarly, when Mr. Garwood was asked in his deposition, quite pointedly, how much stock Allen & Company was going to get, here's what he said. $2 million worth. That's the only answer he could give. $2 million worth.
Is it true that Allen did not cite the non-fulfillment of the various other contingencies as its reason for withdrawing until the case landed in court? because that's what's alleged in the gray brief. Of course, you haven't had an opportunity to respond.
Yes and no. First of all, the reasons that the deal did not close are not the reasons that we are seeking, that we ask the court to enter summary judgment. The reason we asked the court to enter just summary judgment on the promissory estoppel claim was because the promise was contingent, conditional, and indefinite. However, at the time the deal did not close, Mr. Martin said there were three reasons. Hobart's increased demand for stock. We just heard that Hobart was going to get 25.5%. That didn't affect Allen Company because it wasn't coming out of their high. It did affect Allen Company. All of a sudden, they're putting $2 million in, and someone who's putting in $1.7 million in equipment is getting more stock. Yes, that was a reason. Another reason was financial data. And this gets back to Mr. Gleitzman's testimony that's cited in the brief. Plaintiffs cite Mr. Gleitzman's testimony in the brief for the proposition that, gee, Allen Company couldn't come up with the money. Here's what Gleitzman actually said. Ray told me that the reason he could not get any of these people to finally come up with the money was that the numbers, I think it was the balance sheet from Garwood Packaging, had changed yet again. And that gave the investors pause, and they decided they did not want to come forward with the money. So number one, Hobart's increased demand for stock. Number two, new financial data. By the way, this was a moving target, and now it turns out they're not going to have as much post-closing cash as they were supposed to. And finally, a third reason was that Hobart was insisting that Garwood and that McNamara and Bob Sindt would be fired after the closing. Those are the reasons given at the time, but again, the six conditions that we talk about, the reason those conditions are important is because the plaintiffs knew they existed. They claim to have relied on a very vague promise that was subject to multiple conditions and contingencies that had not come to pass and that were outside the control of the promisor. That's why reliance on this promise would not be reasonable. Let me just go back to the terms for one moment, Your Honors. I brought these with me. I didn't burden the court with them in terms of our appendix, which may have already been quite long enough. These are the closing documents. These are the drafts. These were two volumes submitted to the court on summary judgment, over 600 pages, 40 closing documents. These were the final drafts that were generated before the deal closed. If you do look at them, they're obviously part of the record, you will find blanks all over them. Specifically, most importantly, the investment agreement. Article 4 of the investment agreement talks about how much stock people are going to get. They're blanks. Those numbers were never filled in. There was never agreement on such fundamental terms. Let's put aside all of the other issues relating to, you know, ownership rights, different types of stock, voting rights, that kind of thing. They didn't even agree on who was going to get what. That's where this deal was when it fell apart.
Is there a list in there of the creditors and what they have agreed to?
The creditors, there's a list. The creditors had to sign off, yes. And there are releases for the creditors. The creditors had not all signed off.
Do those volumes contain draft releases for all the creditors or just some of the creditors?
I believe they contain releases for all of them.
Even the IRS?
I don't know. Mr. DeMarco has said that getting releases from creditors was not a term. They had to get releases from those they were going to get releases from. That is different from the testimony of his own clients that said, we have to get releases from all creditors. Mr. Garwood stated unequivocally in his deposition, quote, we had to obtain releases from all creditors.
Well, maybe they meant all creditors whom you can get releases from, but not the IRS, for example.
Well, the reason they needed
to... If they know that the IRS never grants these releases, then they wouldn't be meaning to include it in the phrase all creditors.
Well, the reason they had to get releases from creditors, either get them to release in exchange for stock or find a way to pay them, is because the investors were adamant that their investment was not going to be used to pay off existing debt.
Even the IRS?
Not even the IRS.
But then you couldn't have a deal, could you?
Well, the GPI had to find a way.
What did your client think was going to be done about the IRS.
I don't know what they thought. The deal was they had to get a release, so presumably the IRS would have to be paid off.
Well, that's very different from getting a release.
Well, if
unless what release means, you know, if you're paid in full, you give a release, obviously.
Right.
So is that what they mean? So I see. So what you're saying is release for all creditors means that they're either... Right, you get a release from all creditors, but some of them, like the IRS, only give the release after they're paid in full.
And the purpose of, again, getting the releases was that the investors didn't want to put in cash, and then after the deal closed, people turn around and pay creditors with it. That was not the purpose of this investment. And all, and Hobart Gleitzman is very adamant on that point, and so was Allen & Company. But that was just one of the conditions of this deal, Your Honor. There were multiple conditions to this deal. We discussed them.
Well, besides the stock ownership and the creditors, what would be the most important other condition?
One of the most important conditions is securing a strategic securing agreement with a strategic partner. It wasn't just going.
Wasn't that Hobart?
That was Hobart, and that agreement was never reached.
Okay, but that's different. What else is important?
Agreeing to terms, which is what we already alluded to, completing all of the documentation.
I know, but a lot of that is you know, boilerplate stuff. So what would be something that would likely to be a deal breaker?
A deal breaker, the most fundamental term is how much cash or how much stock.
No, I understand that stock and taking care of the creditors could be deal breakers. Are there any other of the unagreed to terms or the blanks in those volumes that could be deal breakers?
Hiring Bob Sindh was a deal breaker. Allen & Company was adamant that Bob Sindh had to be hired as CEO. That's how these things all start to come together, because Hobart, we know Hobart being in the deal was a deal breaker, and we also know from the record that Hobart quit in July of 1994. They said, that's it, we're done.
Because they didn't like Sindh?
Because it was a moving target, because they didn't think they were going to get enough for their investment, and they said, we're done negotiating. GPI came in and said, well, we'll give you more stock.
Was McNamara willing to step aside for Sindh?
Bob Sindh? Well, they were both going to be part of the company, but Sindh was going to be CEO.
The boss, yeah.
Yes. But Hobart didn't like that. Hobart had said, and that was one of the reasons why the investors finally pulled out, was basically what was happening in July of 1994 as a reality was Hobart was trying to take control. They were going to put their people in, they were going to get more stock, and Allen & Company's vision of this deal, among other things, was that Allen & Company would be in control, and that Bob Sindh would be CEO, and that Bob Sindh would run this restructured company. Hobart pulls out in July 1994 and says, we're only coming back in if you give us more stock, and by the way, we're going to fire Peter, we're going to fire Tony, and Bob Sindh's out. So these are fundamental terms. This isn't just a procedural nicety. Who's going to be running this restructured company? These are all very important deal terms that no one ever reached agreement on. When you consider the type of transaction at issue here, Your Honor, this was a multi-million dollar restructuring. It involved negotiations over many months. It required the agreement of dozens of parties, signatures on over 40 closing documents. Plaintiff's promissory estoppel claim, which is the claim that they base their appeal on primarily, failed because there was not a sufficiently definite promise to support the kind of reliance that they're alleging here.
Well, the promise is, you know, I mean, come hell or high water. The key, it seems to me, would be the other contingencies that would have to be satisfied before the restructuring.
There really were two issues that the district court found with the promise. The first one was that there were so many contingencies outside the control of the promisor. And the second one was that the promise was not sufficiently definite to support this kind of reliance.
That's the same thing, isn't it?
I don't think so. I don't think definiteness and contingencies are necessarily the same thing. You can have a conditional promise that's definite, The issue here with indefiniteness was, we're going to give you $2 million in exchange for what? That was the definiteness problem. The conditional problem was, we'll give you $2 million in exchange for what, provided this condition that's outside of our control, this condition are met. So I don't think they're exactly the same thing. Another way to loop around and think about it is the issue of reasonableness of the reliance, which is really the heart of a promissory estoppel claim. The purpose of promissory estoppel is to protect justifiable, reasonable reliance.
Okay, then, and what about the fraud claim? In other words, if Martin did misrepresent the availability of cash to invest, and Garwood can, you know, and show reliance.
The fraud claim is based on basically four things. One, there's a vague statement that at various times he made commitments, which isn't sufficiently specific to support fraud. The other were that during a phone call in July of 1994, Martin represented the funds were there, and then there were two letters in August where he said the funds are there. Those statements were true. The funds were there. And this gets back to the reason the deal closed. The deal did not close. The reason the deal didn't close and didn't move forward and all the conditions weren't eventually resolved was not because Mr. Martin couldn't come up with the money. The funds were there, and his testimony shows that. So first of all, the fraud claim fails because the statements were true. But second of all, these are statements that they say happened in July of 1994, literally days before this deal fell apart. They haven't shown any reliance on those particular statements that would support a claim for fraud. Their contract claim, to touch briefly on that claim, the party's own conduct showed that they never stopped negotiating. There was no deal. There were no terms ever agreed to. In fact, the closing documents that I have here today, there are blanks all over them. There is no contract to enforce. So for these reasons, Your Honors, basically what we have is a highly, highly complex deal that involves the agreement of multiple parties in negotiations over many months. Plaintiffs say that three statements that are very vague and indefinite support a claim that they thought this multi-million dollar transaction was going to close. Plaintiffs' own admissions defeat their claims. Mr. McNamara, former investment banker, told us in his deposition, it is never a deal until the thing is finally done, until the signature is on the piece of paper. I know that. That is what Mr. McNamara told us in his deposition. Your Honor, the district court properly granted summary judgment on the claims for promissory estoppel, fraud, and breach of contract. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Boschkoff. Mr. DeMarco, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Quickly through the points mentioned, did GPI agree to the hiring of Bob Sinn? Definitely. In fact, that's reflected in Exhibit 9, Ray Martin's own note, in which he said that they bought, quote, credible CEO put own money into deal. Bob, $100,000. Tony and Peter assigned absolute control to Bob and Hobart. That is Exhibit 9. Exhibit 29.
Hobart agreed to that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is that?
What's the date on that?
Exhibit 9. Mr. Martin could not identify when he wrote those notes, not surprisingly, Your Honor. But he says, In Exhibit 9, that's the same place he says, it's embarrassing we can't raise $2 million, especially when everyone has agreed. In Mr. Gleitzman's testimony, he said, well, the inference I would draw from that is go to the time period when everyone had agreed, which was the August time period. In terms of what you were asking about the IRS...
anything in there about Hobart agreeing to send?
In Exhibit 9, Your Honor?
Yeah. At least in your quotations from it.
No, this is actually Ray Martin acknowledging that Tony and Peter had assigned absolute control to Bob Sinn and to Hobart. Mr. Mr. Garwood...
I don't see where Hobart has agreed to send.
Hobart agreed to send long before this, Your Honor. Exhibit 1, page 129 describes how, by Mr. Garwood, how everyone agreed that Mr. Sind would come into the deal. In fact, Mr. Gleitzman also testified that he had agreed to hire Mr. Sind as the CEO. And that, he stated, he denied specifically in his affidavit the charge that's being leveled now that he wanted to fire Sind and that was a reason for tanking the deal. In terms of the creditors' question that was raised about the IRS and the other creditors, Mr. Garwood explained that in his affidavit, Exhibit 29, paragraph 11. It was no question the IRS was going to be paid. They weren't giving a release.
Well, they'd give a release after they're paid, right?
Well, yes, but that certainly wasn't going to be something that was done before.
Well, was it known exactly how much money would be paid to the creditors?
Yes, Your
Honor.
Where's
that number?
There's a list of creditors.
Well, where's the number next to the list?
It's not listed next to every creditor, but it is next to some creditors.
That's not good enough.
I believe if you look at...
If people are not going to put money into the company unless they know how much of it is going to go out to the creditors.
I believe if you look at 563, Your Honor, of the defendant's supplement, you see the list with amounts there. That's my recollection.
So you're saying that all the amounts that the creditors would receive had been specified.
Or that creditors would be paid, or that creditors were claiming
that's
not paid.
No, that's not good enough, because there has to be an amount. You can't just say, well, yes, creditor X has to be paid. We don't know how much, but we know he has to be paid in full.
Right.
That's not good enough.
Those amounts were all specified. All the creditors, according to Mr. Garwood's testimony, had agreed to take the amounts that were specified to be paid, or in the IRS's, the IRS would be paid the amount it was owed, or those creditors that were not going to be paid because their charges were disputed, even those were listed on the exhibit that I mentioned.
So there were creditors who weren't going to give releases.
That's right, because as was known by everyone, Hobart, Allen, and GPI, and this is what Mr. Garwood explains in that paragraph 11, there were some creditors whose bills were disputed, and they weren't going to be asked to sign releases because their bills were being
disputed.
Are
you saying there's a paragraph 11 in number 9?
Exhibit 29, Your Honor.
Exhibit 29?
Yes, it's Mr. Garwood's affidavit. There's paragraph 11, I believe, in which he specified, we cited in our brief, in which he specifies what was to be done with all the creditors, and he states that Allen was on board with that the entire time. You asked the question about the fraudulent representations, Your Honor, in July and August. I think these go in two different ways.
Well, I think you ought to comment about the deposition testimony that Ms. Boshkoff referred to.
The deposition testimony, Your Honor, I think she referred to deposition testimony by Mr. Garwood, for example, where she said that they had no idea how much the $2 million was going to get Allen and Company. That's true because the question asked were, do you know how many shares Allen was going to get? And as they sat there in their depositions, they said no. But they referred her to the records, and Mr. Garwood said he said something in the neighborhood of 18%. It turned out to be 18.8%. He was dealing with percentages. She was asking him for the number of shares. Your Honor, I don't know anyone who knows the number of shares they have in their portfolio. They were dealing with it in terms of the amount, $2 million, what that was going to get, 18.8% of the company.
Mr. DeMarco, forgive me, but you're talking about Plaintiff's Exhibit 29?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
My recollection is that's Mr. Garwood's affidavit in which he explained in paragraph 11, consistent with Mr. McNamara's testimony, that the IRS was not to be paid, or the IRS was not to be, was not to give a release in this circumstance. The last point that you raised about the August, I think where that goes, Your Honor, is that it shows the significant credibility problem that Mr. Martin had, because he never told anyone the same story when he pulled out. In fact, what he told Mr. Gleitman was he couldn't get the people, he couldn't get the money from his investors, but realized that a week before that, he said he already had it.
But am I missing something when I worry about the fact that there's no date?
On which, Your Honor?
This Exhibit 9.
Oh, on Exhibit 9? Well, I think in the circumstance we're confronted with, you have to look at it from the light most favorable to the plaintiff, which is it says in there everyone has agreed. When does the plaintiff's evidence show that everyone agreed? It shows that everyone agreed in August of 1994, just before Mr. Martin killed the deal. If you view it in that light, Your Honor, not in the as the district court did, in a light most favorable to the defendant, I think you come up with the opposite result from the district court. I think what you have here is just the same thing we had in Bacardi, where the court said the fact that it's a conditional promise, the fact that it's an indefinite promise, does not preclude application of promissory estoppel, and I think you have to follow that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.